we're certainly hearing that we need to change, and so we're sort of gearing up towards that.
Alaska budget life after the demise of earmarks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 26th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, charges of sexual harassment on board a fishing vessel.
Essentially, he's going to get deported after this case is over because of his illegal alien status.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
A crew member on the fishing vessel Frontier Explorer has been charged with sexual harassment and sexual assault of a National Marine Fisheries Service observer. Victor Chavez Ramirez, age 28, was arrested on Thursday in Unalaska by NOAA special agents, and his arraignment took place on Monday. Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen Skrocky alleged that Chavez Ramirez verbally harassed and groped a NIMFS observer while aboard the vessel Frontier Spirit from August to October 2008. The harassment and assault also impeded the observer's ability to monitor bycatch and collect data, another criminal offense for which Chavez Ramirez is being charged. Skrocky says that while the harassment and assault were alleged to have taken place 2 years ago, the observer approached law enforcement only recently.
We moved on this case relatively quickly once the observer elected to come forward with the allegations that have been charged against Mr. Chavez Ramirez in the information.
Chavez Ramirez is a Mexican citizen, and he has been working in the United States illegally. In 2006, he fled from a deportation matter in the state of Washington. Because of his immigration status, U.S. Magistrate Judge Deborah Smith denied bail for Chavez Ramirez and ordered his detainment. However, Skrocky does not believe that the defendant's immigration status will play a role in his upcoming trial.
His immigration status doesn't really complicate any of it. As we referred to the court at arraignment, he's got an immigration detainer pending at present, which means essentially he's going to get deported after this case is over because of his illegal alien status. So from our perspective, it doesn't complicate the case at all.
Both the Frontier Spirit and the Frontier Explorer are owned by the Seattle-based company Clipper Seafoods Limited. The two freezer longliners were previously operated by the Alaska Frontier Company, but Clipper Seafoods acquired that company while the assault and harassment were allegedly taking place. Dave Little is the president of Clipper Seafoods, and he says that the Alaska Frontier Company had handled the issue.
We bought the Alaska Frontier Company in September of 2008. And as I recall, they had that incident. The previous owners had an incident with this sexual harassment thing, and that was just that was something that that they dealt with. And when we bought the company, that was their issue, not ours.
The defendant has remained in Clipper Seafoods' employ through this year. Little did not comment on Chavez Ramirez's immigration status. The trial will take place on January 11th in Anchorage. Earmarks have a bad rap in Washington, but Alaska has heavily benefited from them. On Wednesday, we looked at the anti-earmark mood of Capitol Hill and what it might mean for Alaska's congressional delegation. Tonight, we dig into what fewer earmarks actually means for Alaskans. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The anti-earmark wave sweeping Washington is tough for people like Kathy Wasserman, executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, the nonprofit, nonpartisan group that counts 140 cities, boroughs, and municipalities as its members, members that seek out earmarks.
The word earmarks has taken on such a bad meaning, and basically earmarks now and pork are the same thing. But a lot of the earmarks that Alaska has gotten over the years, and we're known for getting a lot of earmarks, has been to kind of get our infrastructure caught up. I mean, we're very much behind almost any other state.
Wasserman says Alaska's communities are bracing for cuts and trying to figure out where else funding can come from.
We're always trying to work a year or two ahead of time, so we're certainly hearing that we need to change, and so we're sort of gearing up towards that. For instance, the Alaska Municipal League has taken on one of its priorities for the state to figure out what will happen with our transportation issues when earmarks are no longer accepted or taken, because we have some very huge transportation issues in this state.
Wasserman also serves as a commissioner on the Denali Commission, the state-feds partnership created with the express purpose of spending federal money on basic infrastructure in rural Alaska.
The Denali Commission, by some people's estimation, is one great big giant earmark. But from our way of thinking, it's certainly not pork. The Denali Commission has built health clinics, fuel tanks, because people operate their entire communities off of diesel, washaterias, because someplace that's the only place you can go for water and to do your laundry and take a shower, and there's danger that it might not make it.
There are a couple months yet until the new batch of funding requests have to be turned over to Alaska's congressional delegation, and after that, groups like the Denali Commission will see how they fare. The state is already coping with changes, according to John Katz, director of the governor's D.C. office.
We began to see the handwriting on the wall 2 or 3 years ago and have tried to adapt to that new reality. A couple things that we've been doing. One, we have restricted the number of earmarks that we've requested and the total dollar amount.
Katz says the governor's office asks whether there's widespread community support for requests and the possibility of a state or local match. He says 2 years ago, the state, local governments, and other Alaska groups requested over 700 earmarks. Last year, that dropped to 500.
Even though that's a very sharp reduction from the prior year, it still represents a significant number of earmark requests emanating from Alaska statewide. And it does show that a number of entities in Alaska are still very much dependent on the possibility of federal earmarks.
Alaska has already faced a reduction in earmarks for a number of reasons. The loss of Ted Stevens in the Senate 2 years ago, once a powerful appropriator, and the public anti-earmark outcry, as high up as President Obama, who talked about outlawing earmarks while senator. American University professor James Thurber, who runs the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies, says there's been an earmark drop across the country. But Thurber says while earmarks are on the chopping block, there will likely be other ways to fund projects back home.
Designating expenditures for a particular state or a congressional district will continue in another manner, probably in the regular process within the subcommittees. They will not be called earmarks. They'll just be called expenditures.
Thurber says there is likely to be more transparency and debate in the expenditure funding and perhaps less bragging about bringing home the bacon. Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League says a lot will be revealed in the next few months as groups work up their earmark requests.
The definition of earmarks is going to have a lot to do with this whole issue. So I want to know what the definition of an earmark is. Is it how it's funded? Is it how it comes to the Congress? Is it the process? If there are other ways to get needed infrastructure funded, then perhaps earmarks, quote, going away is not the worst thing in the world.
However, Wasserman asks, if today's earmark is called something else in the future, but still funds Alaska's projects, does anything change, or is it just political maneuvering? In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
You can hear our story from Wednesday about Alaska's congressional delegation's push for earmarks at our website, aprn.org. A search is underway for a woman who is missing after the snow machine she was a passenger on went through the ice near Teller. From Kanawem and Nome, Ben Matheson has the story.
Search and rescue personnel in Teller are looking for Barbara Skolton, who fell through the sea ice while snow machining Wednesday. State troopers were notified of the accident at 8:30 Wednesday night when the driver of the snow machine, Marvin Oakleysick, walked back to the community and said his snow machine had broken through the ice. 44-year-old Barbara Skolton of Teller was the passenger and fell underneath the sea ice. Search and rescue crews from Teller and Shishmaref were unable to launch boats yesterday because of strong currents and floating sea ice. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says that today's search efforts will depend on the conditions.
At this point, the ice is really thin and it's not very safe to go out there and to conduct a full-fledged search. They are trying to look down as much as they can through the ice into the water to see if they can locate the snow machine.
Peters says that an underwater camera is in transit from Bethel. Crews plan to search by boat and snow machine this afternoon if conditions allow. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage gears up for the International Film Festival.
It's really incredible to see all this film frenzy happening in my hometown and be able to come back and really mesh my two worlds together.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
Ryan Romer is a young Alaska Native artist who is being featured in a live art presentation at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage this month. Romer is one of five artists who, during November, lived in a cabin built on campus with one glass wall so that passersby could see them at work. Romer's medium is eclectic. He paints in oils on canvas or makes sculptures or uses the printmaking press he hauled into APU's Carr Gottesdien Hall.
Painting is something I enjoy doing because it's very mobile and it's very inspiring to do, especially with the everyday imagery that we all see that can be contained into a canvas.
Romer is originally from Bethel, but has been living in Anchorage for a decade, where he developed his interest in art through University of Alaska classes.
I'm more into capturing the image itself that I'm working on. So whatever means possible, it being carving a relief out of a woodblock, to painting an acrylic painting, to even doing photography, which I do a lot of. It's more or less capturing the image that I see, and which allows me to bring into a lot of feelings that I can use later on in other images.
Romer says intuition plays a big part in his expression, too, since he lives with family members who live in a traditional manner. He says he's most interested in the dramatic social changes that are facing Alaska Natives all across the state.
I recently went out to the Kuskokwim River this past winter and spring and took a lot of pictures for a body of work I was working on. And I went out there with the emphasis that I wanted to capture what was going on in the villages that I was traveling through, that people were doing that day that images weren't capturing maybe 5 years prior or 10 years prior. And a lot of that had to do with technology and transportation had changed a little bit on the river. You know, that traveling around up and down to Kuskokwim, I'd run across more people carrying GPSs and laptops in their backpacks, whereas I've never heard of that 10 years prior.
He says contemporary Alaska Native artists of the past decade are tasked with interpreting that challenge. He says currently he's the only one in his family producing art, but younger members of his family are following in his footsteps. Next Friday, the Anchorage Film Festival begins, International Film Festival begins. After 9 years of struggling to survive as an all-volunteer effort, this year the festival has a staff and a rich field of entries. APRN Steve Heimel tells us more.
International is a key word with a strong set of entries from Canada, but also from such places as Turkey, Iraq, France, and even a big historical epic from China. For the most part, these are movies that are unlikely to see regular theatrical release. Festival founder Tony Shepard, a movie-loving ad man, says he started the festival so people in Alaska could see these sorts of movies. The market in the state is such that, for the most part, art films, shorts, experimental films, and niche films just don't get much screen time. After a phase of expansion to 3 or 4 simultaneous screenings daily lasting for 2 weeks, this year the festival has scaled back and put a big emphasis on quality. Prices are up, but that means the budget is stronger, and Shepard likes the result.
Overall, between the submissions and some of the donations and the gate, yes, we make enough money to really put on, pound per pound, one of the best festivals in the States.
More of the filmmakers are coming to Alaska to introduce their films, and there are more workshops this year. Shepard says he had to be talked into scaling back to just two screens, but he likes the result. Though, unlike in the past, many of the feature-length films are only going to get shown once.
Look, if you're really into going and doing the festival the right way, plan in advance. I'd have to say about half the films only have one screening this year. Unfortunately, that means, yeah, you only have one opportunity in some cases. So it's going to be difficult, but I do believe that if you plan accordingly and you want to see most of the features, you'll be able to do that because we do have the ones in competition primarily that will screen twice.
In the second week, they'll schedule the films that are judged the best for another viewing. This 10th festival takes place at a time when the film industry itself is growing in Alaska thanks to tax credits passed by the legislature. And this makes filmmakers more interested in this out-of-the-way festival in the far north. One film in competition is produced by a former Alaskan, K.D. Miller. It's a horror picture with a sizable dose of humor, directed by the Butcher Brothers, creators of the cult favorite The Hamiltons and April Fool's Day.
It's very creative and yet a horror film, which is why it got into Sundance this last January and was able to play within that that front. And also, it's got three different Alaskans in it. So myself from West High, and then also Joseph McAleer, who graduated from West, and then Brett Roberts. So it's a really exciting time to kind of come home and be able to play it in that forum.
Miller is based in Los Angeles now, but she's spending more and more time back in Alaska due to the industry's new interest in shooting here. She has started a company called Feature Alaska to help develop an Alaska workforce for motion picture shoots.
And so it's been a really great ride, and it's really incredible to see all this film frenzy happening in my hometown and be able to come back and really mesh my two worlds together.
And she hopes to mesh her company's training efforts with the film program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The Anchorage International Film Festival will be screening at the Beartooth Cinema and Out North, as well as some screenings at the Anchorage Library and Museum. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Southeast Alaska art stands out in the collection of the National Museum of the American Indian. The Smithsonian branch on the Mall in Washington, D.C. has thousands of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian objects in its collections, and many are before the public. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld paid a trip to the museum to find out more about what's on display.
It's hard not to spot Southeast Alaska Native art in the National Museum of the American Indian. There's the Nathan Jackson totem pole depicting a man who lived with a bear near the ground floor gift shop, or the carved 1890s dance staff in a case by the Rasmussen Theater, or even the 1960s button blanket-clad figure in the third floor dolls exhibit. But one of the largest assemblages is on the top level.
I'm starting on the fourth floor here because this is actually what we recommend to our visitors, is that they start on the fourth floor and work their way down. Why don't we first start with our windows on collection?
Cultural interpreter Cheryl Pahi takes me to a series of glass cabinets showcasing 3,000 objects representative of the larger collection. The section focusing on animals contains classic Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian work, clan-crested feast bowls, a hand-carved decorated canoe, and a wooden crab on wheels.
And then we have some pipes. You can see from the Tlingit community, we have a bear pipe on the left and we have a bear claw pipe on the right. And then we have a bentwood box coming from the Tlingit as well.
Rattles, masks, an octopus bag. Images of raven, bear, frog, and other clans greet out-of-town visitors peering into the case.
So much of the work from that whole general area is absolutely superlatively beautiful.
Mary Jane Lenz is a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian.
And So when it comes time to choose things that you want to show to a public that isn't familiar with that area, you have such a huge pool of things to choose from that it's really, in a way, kind of an embarrassment of riches.
Lynn says Southeast Native works, with their stylized animal imagery or intricate beadwork, fit well into the introductory exhibits. She says they're a view into cultures little known to visitors more familiar with Southwest Indian groups, such as the Navajo or the Hopi. But the longtime collector and museum staffer says they stand on their own as art, and she has her favorites.
They're carved wooden chief's rattles, rather small and very brightly painted. And they all have a kind of general shape of a flying raven. And then usually on the back of the raven, there's a kind of mysterious figure lying on the back and having some kind of an interaction with another animal.
The National Museum of the American Indian has about 1 million objects in its Washington, D.C. site, its New York City branch, and its archives. Most come from George Gustav High, son of a German immigrant, who assembled one of the nation's most comprehensive collections of native art. The rest have been more recently purchased or donated. One Tlingit artist well represented on the museum shelves is Amos Wallace. The Juneau carver, who died in 2004, was known for his grand totems, intricate silver jewelry, and wooden sculptures.
I can still remember sitting next to my father as he was carving the whale figurines.
Brian Wallace is one of Amos's sons. He's talking about a circular red, tan, and black killer whale on display in the windows on collections.
I can still remember the smell of the cedar, the sound of the blades going across the wood, and to see it on display where millions can see it right now is just totally fills me with pride.
Southeast Native culture's biggest Smithsonian display came several years ago. Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian objects were prominent in the exhibit, listening to our ancestors, the art of native life along the North Pacific coast. The show opened in the Washington Museum in 2006 and moved to its New York branch before closing in 2008. It remains on view online. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
Major work will begin next year on restoring the Japonski Island Boathouse. The Sitka Maritime Heritage Society has spent the past several years stabilizing the World War II-era structure in piecemeal fashion. The organization now plans to spend more than $300,000 toward reopening the building as a working wooden boat shop and marine museum. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Maritime Heritage Society President Rebecca Polson shared her group's plans in a presentation to the Sitka Chamber of Commerce. She said final costs for the completed project would reach $1.4 million for a turnkey boat shop and museum. The society has raised about a quarter of that, enough to get started. She said Sean Boiley of Juneau's Northwind Architects had created a very spare, efficient design for the structure.
And our concept is to keep it, to make it feel as if it never closed. So not like a visitor center, but more like you're invited to come into this working shop.
The boathouse is included in a National Historic Landmark that covers much of the Japonski waterfront. Its formal name is suggestive of the importance the area played at the outbreak of the war. The Sitka Naval Operating Base and U.S. Army Coast Defenses National Historic Landmark. Polson says the Army and Navy ultimately serviced a fleet of about 60 vessels at the Japonski Boathouse, using some 40 shipwrights. The relatively small building was not really adequate to the task. She says plans were underway to build a larger facility when the war ended. The boathouse entered civilian life as the repair shop for the shore boats that operated between Japonski and Baranof Islands prior to the construction of the O'Connell Bridge. It later was part of Mount Edgecombe High School's vocational program before the state took over and reopened the school as an academic institution. Polson told the chamber that the Maritime Heritage Society had invested $160,000 stabilizing the structure. The building has been cleaned, painted, and new footings have been poured. But she had even better news for the business community.
It turns out we've got, you know, in addition to the money we've already raised and spent, we've got $325,000 in federal grants that we've got to use in 2011.
The Maritime Heritage Society 4 years ago received $325,000 in a Save America's Treasures grant. It has spent some of that money on stabilization and used some to leverage other funding from National Scenic Byways and the Rasmussen Foundation. It is the balance of the Save America's Treasures funding that must be spent next year. Polson said the project has been divided into phases: roof, mechanical and electrical, and a small addition with an accessible entrance and bathrooms. Polson said the boathouse work would likely not need outside expertise.
We're lucky right now there's a lot of good contractors in town. You know, these young guys my age. And the boathouse is about the size of a large house. There's nothing real specialized except the marineways, and then it's a historic building. So we hope to have it going out to bid in February, and we're definitely counting on a local contractor.
One aspect of the work slightly out of the ordinary, at least for now, will be the installation of a ground source heat pump. The boat shop historically was never heated, but visitors to the site will be glad that the State Historic Preservation Office is allowing heat in the new bathroom addition and museum wing. Polson said the society has plans to install the coolant coils for the system on the beach under the track of the new railway. Polson was joined by Maritime Heritage Society board member Joe D'Arienzo, who told the chamber that the group had reopened negotiations with Delta Western to sublease a portion of the boathouse uplands for a new marine fuel dock. Delta Western shelved plans for a dock when the nationwide recession took hold in 2008. D'Arienzo said the society anticipated lease revenues of 6 cents a gallon when the dock is complete. The money will be used to fund an executive director's position. The dock will include a separate float for launching kayaks. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Alan Lockyer in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.